The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This episode is brought to you by my friend Rebecca Walzer, a financial expert who can help you protect your wealth. Book your free call with her team by going to friendofdinesh.com. That's friendofdinesh.com. Coming up, Ron DeSantis is jumping into the presidential race, and I'll explore some of the implications. I'll review the shifting politics of the Middle East, as revealed in the recent Arab summit. Not good news for the United States. Another Soros-funded DA goes down. Danielle D'Souza Gill is in studio. We'll talk about that. And I'll report on how Egyptians are responding to Hollywood's decision to cast Cleopatra as a black woman. Hey, if you're watching on Rumble or listening on Apple, Google, or Spotify, please hit the subscribe button. I'd appreciate it. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Show.
Needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Today is a big day in American politics and a big day in Republican politics. Why? Because reportedly, later today, 6 p.m., I believe, Eastern, Ron DeSantis is going to jump into the presidential race, joining, of course, Trump, joining Tim Scott, joining Vivek Ramaswamy, joining Nikki Haley. So, hey, this is going to be, well, at this point, a semi-crowded field. Who knows who else is going to jump in? Now, there are some people who would hope that Ron DeSantis would not enter the race, that he would wait this one out, that he would, not only in deference to Trump, but in a sense calculating his own interests, say, look, why jump in now? Is it really possible for me to defeat Trump for the 2024 nomination? Isn't it going to leave me bruised? I most likely won't succeed, but even if I do succeed, will I be insufficiently battered up at that point that I will not be leading a unified Republican ticket? So anyway, I'm sure Ron DeSantis has considered all of this. It's certainly quite obvious to those who are willing to kind of look at what the political facts are on the ground. And yet Ron DeSantis has decided to do it. He's going to jump in. And so the fateful step is now taken. He's also doing it in an unusual way. You might expect the typical press conference or even television appearance where Ron DeSantis, but I think it's a mark of how our society is changing that Ron DeSantis is going to make his announcement on Twitter. He's going to do it in a Twitter discussion with Elon Musk that is moderated by a friend of ours, but also a friend of Elon Musk, and that is David Sacks, the entrepreneur. And this is very interesting because on the one hand, it seems to suggest that Elon Musk is behind DeSantis. And there's some evidence for that. In fact, in interviews, Elon Musk has said that if he was casting a vote, he does support the candidacy of DeSantis. And in a recent interview on CNBC, Elon Musk was asked, what do you think about Trump? What do you think about Biden? And Musk sort of put some distance with both of them, saying in effect that I just want, quote, a normal human being to lead the country. So presumably Musk is saying, I don't know, because of age or because of temperament, that Trump and Biden both don't meet this standard. And then it's clear also that Elon Musk has an operational view of this. He goes, it's not simply a matter of do they share your beliefs, but are they good at getting things done? Musk seems to think that one of the things DeSantis brings to the table is an ability that he's demonstrated in Florida to get things done, to focus on policy and not so much perhaps on personality. Now, what is kind of funny is that when Elon Musk had earlier said that he liked Ron DeSantis, this was before DeSantis, of course, was even, he was maybe considering running for president, but it was all speculation at that point. And DeSantis was asked, hey, what do you think about the fact that Elon Musk likes you? He replied, I welcome my support from African Americans, which I think is actually a great line. Elon Musk, of course, is white, but he is from South Africa. So in that sense, he is an African who is now in America and I suppose technically qualifies as an African American. Now, this is going to really change the race. I realize that there are many people who think Trump already has the nomination secured, but there are certainly big implications to having DeSantis in the race. Why? Because DeSantis is a serious candidate. Look, the other guys are, I'm sure, in their own minds, serious candidates, and I'm not really here to say they're not. They have every right to run, and many of those people are in various walks of life very accomplished. Vivek Ramaswamy as a very successful entrepreneur, Nikki Haley, former governor, and then ambassador to the United Nations, Tim Scott, senator from South Carolina. So these aren't trivial people. But nevertheless, if it was them against Trump, you could see Trump basically running away with it, and then the sort of skeptics or the people who don't like Trump distributing their votes among these other candidates probably relatively evenly. But DeSantis has his own following, and he has an enthusiastic following among some people who think not only that he is the best guy in the race, but they also think he's the only guy who can beat Biden. Now, polls on this are a little inconsistent. In fact, Trump has been trumpeting, putting forward polls that show that, no, Trump is the guy who can beat Biden. And of course, Trump is decisively leading DeSantis in the Republican race. But I smell trouble here, and I smell trouble in the sense that I'm a little worried, and I've said this on the podcast before, about these two candidates bruising each other. So I'm speaking here, keeping the interests of the Republican Party, and even more important, of the country in the front of my mind. I want to see a unified Republican ticket. I want to see a Republican ticket that unifies our team and then reaches out to independents and middle of the roaders, points out the horrors of the Biden regime, wins over some of those guys to our side. And hey, then we have an electoral majority and possibly even a popular majority. But the nightmare scenario is that this rivalry between Trump and DeSantis becomes so acrimonious, bruising to both sides, that it creates a fractured party. The Democrats, interestingly enough, are not so fractured. They're pretty united, and they're going to put up a fairly united front. It's kind of like, they whip their troops into line. Let's get behind Biden. That's what happened in 2020, and we can foresee that happening again in 2024. Sure, I know that Robert F. Kennedy is in there. There may be one or two other guys who get in there. I don't know. But I think as a party, there's a high degree of discipline on the Democratic side. And there's no evidence that there's any kind of enforcement mechanism on the Republican side that's equivalent. I realize the RNC, Rona McDaniel, they're trying to get everyone to sign a pledge that they will support the ultimate candidate. But think about it. The very fact that you need to sign a pledge shows you that there's genuine concern that that will not be the case. But we need a united ticket, or else we're facing really a nightmare prospect, 4 more years of the Democrats in the White House. For the last couple of weeks, you've heard me tell you about Angel Tree Camp and ask you to help send children with a mom or dad in prison to camp this summer. So many of you have answered the call. Angel Tree Camps are operated by the nonprofit Prison Fellowship, founded by Chuck Colson. And the mission is simple: get prisoners' kids out of bad neighborhoods or tough home situations and bless them with the fresh air and fun of a Christ-centered camp that can transform their lives forever. This is really heartwarming. And if you're wondering how much impact your donation might have, just listen to these incredible words from Angel Tree's Betsy Wright.
You know, they dropped their child off at the beginning of the week. Child was super hesitant, just didn't know if they wanted to go to camp. And by the end of the week, when mom comes back to pick them up, they're crying because they don't want to go home, because they had so much fun. And we hear, I think it was a grandmother, she said, this was the first time that my child went to sleep without the sounds of gunshot at night.
The cost to help bless one child with a week of Angel Tree camping is only $200, so your donation in any amount will combine with others to send the child of a prisoner to camp this summer. 400 will bless two kids, and so on. Just go to my website, DineshDeSouza.com, click on the Angel Tree banner at the top of the page, or you can phone in your gift by calling 888-206-2801. The number again, 888-206-2801. Once again, go to DineshDeSouza.com, click on the Angel Tree camp banner to help change a child's life for eternity. Not many Americans are paying attention to what is happening around the world. It seems like our national mood is largely inward. A lot of focus on domestic issues, cultural issues, moral issues, domestic politics. Now, of course, there is the Ukraine war going on, and the Biden regime has been foursquare behind Zelensky and behind Ukraine, and refusing to even consider the possibility of a negotiated settlement between the two parties. And of course, we're aware that other parties, including China and Turkey, stepping forward and trying to find some way to broker a peace deal in Ukraine. But there is a reconfiguration of power balances around the world. And this is worth paying attention to because it has very long-term consequences. By and large, what seems to be happening now is not good for us, not good for the United States as a country. Why? Because after the Cold War, it seems that the United States had, well, the world was at our doorstep, and the Soviets had basically imploded. There was no superpower rival. The United States was a unipolar power. It had a defense mechanism, a defense budget, a defense operation that rivaled like the next seven countries all put together, so no one could pose a real military threat. But through our own fault and through America's neglect and foolishness and lack of diplomacy, we have now allowed the emergence of a really powerful rival, except this time it's not a single country. Some people think, well, China has taken the place of the Soviet Union, but China by itself would not be that formidable. Formidable, but not that formidable. But what happens when you take China and then you add Russia? And then what if you take China and Russia and you add Turkey and Iran and pretty much all of the Middle East? With the exception of one or two Gulf kingdoms and, of course, the tiny state of Israel, well, suddenly now you're dealing, and then you add in Brazil, you add in South Africa. I'm talking now about the BRICS countries, which are forming an economic and a currency alliance. Then you add in countries like Cuba and Venezuela and other left-wing regimes in South America. Now you're dealing with a formidable global adversary and one that has power and footprints in your own backyard. Now, I want to zoom in as part of an examination of this to what's been happening in the Middle East. So if you've been following the Middle East was divided really into two camps. The pro-American camp, which was mainly made up of Saudi Arabia and some of the Gulf kingdoms, and then the anti-American camp that was largely led by Iran. And the American camp and the Iran camp, if you will, were enemies. They never met. They never did deals together. They were opponents. They, in fact, funded each other as adversaries. Iran was funding groups in Saudi Arabia that were trying to bring down the government of Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, by contrast, were looking forward to the collapse of the Iranian regime. And then you have other countries like Syria, which were also part of this kind of volatile clash of regimes in the region. So, for example, Syria and Saudi Arabia were enemies, were deadly enemies. And the idea that those two governments would meet together, would sort of create a warm embrace, was almost unthinkable 5 or 10 years ago. But now things have changed. We just had in Riyadh the Arab summit. Now, interestingly, Zelensky was at the Arab summit. He was there to make an appeal for Ukraine. But also at the Arab summit were all these once fighting regimes. And it was very notable that Mohammed bin Sultan, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, steps forward and does a very public and symbolic hug to a beaming Assad. Who's Assad? The dictator of Syria. There's been a Syrian civil war. The Saudis were actually funding the opponents of Assad in that war. And yet here they are like old friends. What this really means is that Saudi Arabia is pulling away from the United States. And I've said before, the reason for this is that the Biden regime has been treating the Saudis as murderers, the Saudis as sort of a murderous regime. And needless to say, when someone calls you a murderer, you're not all that well disposed to the person making that accusation. And you go, basically, screw you, to heck with you, I'll find other friends and allies. And that's exactly what Mohammed bin Sultan is doing. Now, this is not to say that it's all friends and roses and champagne toasts, because there's an interesting rivalry between Bashar Assad in Syria and Turkey. And so part of what's going on here is that Assad is trying to make friends in the Middle East, his own neighborhood, so to speak. He says to keep out the influence of Turkey. So he made this rather interesting statement. He said there's a danger of Ottoman expansion. And Ottomans refers, of course, to the Turks. The Turks have always been a very powerful regime in the orbit of Islam. Now, Turkey is not in the Middle East. Turkey is actually in Europe. But at one point, Turkey ruled most of Europe. And Assad is basically implying that the Turks want to do that again. So all of this is a way of saying that the political maps are shifting, old enemies are becoming friends, and all of this is not to the benefit of the United States, because the United States is trying to keep the Saudis away and the Gulf kingdoms away from Iran, away from Syria. Basically, they say, listen, don't shake hands with those guys unless they improve their record on human rights and so on. But clearly, the Saudis don't care. Of course, Assad doesn't care. And so we are looking now at an increasingly hostile landscape in the Middle East where American power once dominated. Former President Trump recently issued a warning from Mar-a-Lago, and I quote, "Our currency is crashing and will soon no longer be the world standard, which will be our greatest defeat, frankly, in 200 years. Some experts believe there are serious threats to the future value of the U.S. dollar because of inflation, deficit spending, and our increasing national debt." Now, one asset that has withstood famine, wars, and economic upheaval dating back to biblical times is gold. And you can own it in a tax-sheltered retirement account with the help of Birch Gold. Birch Gold will help you convert an existing IRA or 401k, maybe from a previous employer, into an IRA in gold. And the best part, you don't pay a penny out of pocket. So get started. Text Dinesh to 989898. Claim your free information kit in gold. Think about this. In March of this year, when the banks faltered, the stock market faltered, gold surged. Birch Gold can help you find out how to protect your savings with gold. Birch Gold has an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, thousands of happy customers. So text Dinesh to 989898. Get your free information kit on gold and get started. The number to text Dinesh to 989898. Guys, my daughter Danielle D'Souza Gill is here visiting and in studio and also pregnant, due in July. This is going to make Debbie and me into grandparents. And in fact, we are giving some intense thought to our grandparent names. If you have any suggestions for a grandparent name for me, I'd like to hear it, but no weird ideas, please. There's not going to be any gender reveals on the show. And Danielle, tell why.
Well, because I don't know the gender, so I'm going to find out when the baby's born and be surprised. And the baby will not choose their gender. It'll be established gender.
Are you saying it'll be established by biology and destiny,
yes, exactly.
And not by personal inclination?
I will find out, and everyone else will find out once the baby's born.
Yeah. I guess this idea of finding out about which gender it is, it used to be that a lot of people wouldn't know. And I suppose in old times it was like that by necessity. But apparently your doctor told you that these days, almost everybody does know.
Everybody wants to know as soon as possible. And I think with technology, it used to be that, you'd find out around 20 weeks when they did the big ultrasound, but now you can do blood work and find out even earlier. So a lot of people usually know from the very beginning and just like make their plan for boy or girl. But no, not me.
Now, what was the reason for you and Brandon deciding to kind of go the, not the agnostic route, but go the route of, hey, we'll just stay in suspense? Because obviously your planning is a little easier if you do know.
Yeah, some people ask me that. They'll say, oh, how do you know what outfits to get them? How do you know how to decorate the room and stuff like that? But I didn't want to do it based on the decoration just to find out. But I've heard it's very special to find out in the moment, because I think when you have the birth, you're spouse or like, or you just find out the gender and it's like, it's a boy or it's a girl, and it's a very cool moment. And then also because then people are so excited, the baby's there, they're not like coming up with hypothetical scenarios of, you know, if it should be a boy or girl, because sometimes if you, you know, find out before, tell people, let's say you want to name it Thomas, then everyone's like, oh, I don't like the name Thomas, or whatever it is. But if the baby's already born, you say, this is Thomas, and everyone's like, oh, wow, what an amazing name.
Yes, they are, yeah. There's already a human being in the world to be given the name.
Yeah, and of course, we are pro-life, so that is a human being. But just in the sense that I think it's just more the traditional way. Most people didn't know for thousands of years what the gender was, I guess, other than maybe some myths about, like, how high you're carrying the baby or things like that. But other than that, it's pretty much just the old-fashioned way of, you know, find out when it pops out.
No, the people at Target are probably not going to be very happy with your decision to reject the transgender approach, because Target is apparently issued a new line of queer and transgender clothes for children. I want to italicize. And even though they've been putting this out in the front of the store because of so-called, you know, Pride Week, the truth of it is there's a whole difference in, on the one hand, saying, okay, we endorse the idea of pride. That's problematic enough. Why are corporations getting into this kind of thing? But even if you do that, it's a different manner to push this kind of propaganda on children. Apparently, they have little girls' bathing suits, which have a spot for male genitalia, a kind of a tuck. How weird is that? And so there is a backlash that is brewing that may end up being more than the backlash on Bud Light. Now, what do you think about all this? I mean, basically, customers are seeing this in the front of the store and they're going a little berserk because they recognize that this is part of a systematic assault on children.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally disgusting. And I don't even know, like, it's obviously just about the woke signaling, because obviously there's no actual need to have what you mentioned on a girl's outfit.
This is not a market.
It's not even about that. It's obviously just about a parent who's super liberal saying, I'm going to buy this for my kid because I want everyone to know my kid is a gender neutral, gender fluid, or supports this, even though the baby is just born and doesn't support this, I'm sure. But it's just probably just a way for the parents to show that they're super liberal. And hopefully no one buys their stuff.
Here's the Target CEO, Brian Cornell. He says that this woke capitalism is good for the brand. And he goes, it's, quote, the right thing for society. He says that this is something that Target is committed to. But guess what? The interesting news is that because of the backlash, which is only just now going, in fact, people are specifically talking about Bud Lighting Target. And the idea is Bud Light has taken a massive hit. In fact, Bud Light is now being whopped from both sides because the LGBT, as Bud Light tries to show, no, we're not, you know, Dylan Mulvaney is not our guy. And they're now releasing very traditional ads with country music bands and so on. The LGBTQ people are going, now we hate Bud Light. So everybody hates Bud Light. And of course, a lot of other options, and similarly with Target. Initially, I was thinking, you know, the beer drinker types are going to be more conservative, so a Bud Light boycott is going to be more effective. But now when I think about the fact that there are so many retail stores and they're so dependent on maintaining their audience, that if people begin to start fleeing Target, even 20%, 30%, it's going to be a massive blow for this chain. And the Target people know that. In fact, I just read that Target has now had an emergency meeting, and they've put out the word to stores in the Midwest and the South, move the gay stuff to the back of the store. So Target is now trying to hide the fact, well, you know, apparently it was gay pride. Now it's sort of gay embarrassment. So they haven't removed the products, but what they've done is relocated them, taken down the signage. Not across the country. Maybe in some places this kind of stuff is popular. But it's interesting to see that I think from the consumer side, there's now an awareness that these boycotts have real power.
Yeah, well, I also think that, unfortunately, because so many companies are woke, people lose track of what companies they're supposed to boycott, where they can get something, where they can't. But I think right now the focus should just be Bud Light and Target, because otherwise people forget and then they go shop there anyways, when in reality they're doing the worst, I guess, of the other ones. So even though Walmart, for example, is, I think, liberal, they're not as bad as Target right now, so veer away from Target, head to their competitor, Walmart, for now. And then that way, Target will learn their lesson.
I mean, here's an example of strategy. The left doesn't go after every bakery. They go after one Christian baker, mm-hmm. right? And they don't mind if people go to other Christian bakers or to other bakers in general, because they realize it's difficult to boycott 17 people or 100 people. It's easier to attack one. You kind of gang up on this one guy, teach him a lesson, and everybody else gets the message. That's really what's going on our side now. And people go, well, you're doing the same kind of canceling that the left is doing. Exactly. Because if the left is going to engage in cancel culture, we're going to shut you down. Guess what? Two people can play at that game. So my point is that cancel culture is an effective answer to cancel culture. Just as, what is an effective answer to the force employed by the criminal? The force employed by the cop.
Well, in both cases, you're using force, Dinesh.
Yeah, exactly. Force is needed to stop force. So the point being here, let's make an example of Bud Light. Let's make an example of Target. Let's bring these corporations to the ground, and then other people will get the message. We are in the most vulnerable time in U.S. history with our markets and our economy, and that calls for an expert financial advisor for your investments. Now, most Americans have a conventional kind of ride out the dips in the market, do nothing advisors that have kept recycling the same advice since the 1980s. And you know what? It doesn't work. That advice will fail you. Luckily, my friend Rebecca Walser, you've seen her on the podcast, she has a really sound grasp of both global and American markets. And she's different. She's a tax attorney. She's a wealth strategist with her global MBA from the London School of Economics. She has seen what is coming and protected her clients back at the end of 2021. And she can do the same for you now. Debbie and I just did a call with Rebecca's team to talk about our investments. So join us. Go to friendofdinesh.com to book a call with Rebecca's team today. That's friendofdinesh.com to secure your investments and your future. Interesting development in North Carolina, where the legislature passed a bill affirming school choice. And the governor, a Democrat, not only said he would veto it and did veto it, but he claimed that there is a statewide emergency. He calls it the emergency for public education. He's almost treating it like a hurricane is coming to hit North Carolina. And the hurricane in this case turns out to be Republicans who are giving parents a choice about where to send their kids to school. Hey, here is a scholarship. You can send your kid to a public school or to a private school of your choice. And fortunately, the good news is that North Carolina, by very narrow margin, has a supermajority, which means that the Republicans are now in a position and are going to override Governor Cooper's veto. And that means that school choice is coming to North Carolina. North Carolina now becomes, I don't know, the seventh, the eighth. Texas recently passed school choice. So this is a new and important movement around the country. And isn't it interesting that a governor, supposed to be a moderate governor of a right-leaning state, is trying to shut down school choice, even though the public schools are like, well, I mean, they are like a disaster zone.
Yeah. And the fact that we have this supermajority to overrule this guy shows that so many people support school choice in North Carolina. North Carolina is pretty much a swing state. So it really shows how bad public schools have gotten, and the fact that, you know, all Republicans should be supporting school choice. Even people who aren't Republicans should support school choice, because it'll just make our schools better. Kids will have a better education. So I think this governor is really embarrassing himself, because if he ran as a moderate Democrat, then he's not acting like that once he's in office. And clearly he's going to be shown to be kind of a loser, because he's going to lose on this issue, and North Carolina is going to be better for it. And hopefully then next time he runs for election or another Democrat runs, he's going to lose too.
Well, 7 in 10 North Carolina voters support greater school choice. This, by the way, is about the same as around the country. You know, for a long time, going back to the 80s and 90s, the issue's been around, but even Republicans were divided on it. Why? Because there were Republicans in suburban districts, and they're like, we got to support our public schools. Y'all, we like, our moms like to go to the school football game. So there was this kind of sentimental support. But public schools have just gotten worse and worse and worse. So they've gotten more and more money, and standards have declined to such a point that there are public schools now that produce essentially an ocean of stupidity. Even the valedictorian is an idiot. So,
if you wanted to with school choice, you could still send your kid to the public school they were going to. So it's not like you're, you know, prohibited from doing that. So if you're a parent who really likes the school game, you can still do that.
There are 23 schools in Baltimore City which had zero students who tested proficient in math. Not a single student. 23 schools in 23 whole schools. And then in one of those Baltimore schools, a high school student almost graduated at the top half of his class after failing every class but three in 4 years.
Wow.
So in other words, what they're doing is they're lowering the standards. So that this is almost, honey, what is that film? Idiocracy, where you're basically living in a stupid world. Well, we don't live in a stupid world, but we live in a stupid world of public schools. And my guess is that half of these teachers are also stupid. And by that, I mean, they're not even interested in education. They're just a part of the union. They're collecting salaries. They're probably semi-ignoramuses themselves. Maybe I don't even know if they know the course material.
Maybe they also went to that school.
They might have gone to that school. Or put it differently, the student is in the fourth grade, the teacher really belongs in the fifth grade. So what's going on here is there's just an ongoing crisis. And, you know, it used to be we'd compare the stupidity of our students with students around the world. Oh, we're falling behind other industrialized countries. I don't even think there's any comparison to be made anymore. We're kind of in a class of our own in terms of dumbness. It should be these are all the countries ranked, and then at the bottom, a special, like, special low ranking is the United States public schools, that is, which is to say that we have to build now from the ground up. And I don't think this can be done inside the public school system. There's no saving it.
There are a lot of other good options. Homeschooling exploded during COVID. Lots of other charter schools. There are certain public schools where you have to take a test to get in. And I know those are very competitive schools. There are, of course, Christian schools. There are lots of other options that are actually good schools, but some people can't afford it because their tax dollars are going to this public school. So now with school choice, they can go to these better schools, and the kids don't have to. Because what if you're a kid who actually wants to learn something and you're stuck in this class where every single other student is causing, you know, a huge ruckus, no one's paying attention to anything, the teacher can't control the classroom. Sometimes there's crime in classrooms. I mean, if every single student is failing every single class, every single grade, there's obviously no learning taking place here. So what happens to that kid? Basically, they're left behind, even though they're not a bad kid. So that parent probably wants to put them somewhere else where they can actually learn something.
And on top of it, you have this ideology that is now widespread in public schools that meritocracy is white supremacy. Think about that, because that really means now a lot of parents don't believe it. And of course, there are Asian parents who are like, listen, doesn't matter what they teach you. You study hard. You do well. You want to have a good future. But this, nothing could be more destructive to education and educational excellence than the idea that merit is somehow a Caucasian or a white concept. So the public schools, I think, are many of them unsalvageable. And I'm really glad to see that North Carolina is joining the states, mostly Republican states, I will say, where school choice is becoming a way out of this destructive, this educational disaster.
And it's definitely not a white concept, because many white communities are falling behind. It's not just, you know, black communities. unfortunately, Black communities, white communities are doing really badly. It's really just some Asian communities that are actually doing well in public schools.
If aches and pains are your problem, Relief Factor is your solution. Debbie and I started taking Relief Factor a couple of years ago. The difference we've seen in our joints, nothing short of amazing. Aches and pains are totally gone thanks to this 100% drug-free solution called Relief Factor. How does it work? Relief Factor supports your body's fight against inflammation. That's the source of aches and pains. The vast majority of people who try Relief Factor become regular customers. They order more because it works for them. Debbie's a true believer. She can now do the exercises that for a long time she wasn't able to do so. Relief Factor has been a big game changer for her, her aunt, other members of our family, Mike here in the studio, and many other people. You too can benefit. Try it for yourself. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of only $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF to find out more about this offer. The number again, 800-4-RELIEF, or go to relieffactor.com. Feel the difference. Really good news out of Massachusetts. U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins, by the way, this is one of the Soros-funded DAs, is resigning. She's down the tube. She's out of there. Now, she's out of there, interestingly enough, for violating the Hatch Act. What's the Hatch Act? It's the act that prohibits certain government officials who are supposed to be impartial. Remember, Rachel Rollins is supposed to be the prosecuting attorney, make decisions based on the law and the merits. But the Hatch Act says you can't get involved in partisan politics. And she has two serious violations of the Hatch Act, one bad and the other worse. The bad one is that she shows up at a political fundraiser in her official capacity for Jill Biden. That's not allowed. But number two, far worse, she tried to sabotage the political campaign of a candidate that she didn't like by leaking information. This was information that was top secret, known only to the DOJ, leaking it to the media to damage the opposing candidate. And this was, by the way, in collusion with the opposing candidate. The opposing candidate was, by the way, a guy named Richard Arroyo, whom she supported. Arroyo goes, your office should open up an investigation into my opponent. And then Rollins goes, quote, understood, keep fighting and campaigning. I'm working on something. And he goes, it would be the best thing I can have happen at this moment. So one political candidate is trying to undercut another by opening up an investigation. She's part of this. So apparently when there was an investigation of this, this was described as an almost unprecedented violation of the Hatch Act. And so I'm really happy to say that the Soros-funded DA is exiting the stage.
Yeah. And I wonder if there are more like this, because so many Soros-funded DAs, I'm sure, use their office for, of course, things like political persecution, but probably also things like this, like campaigning for other people and violating the Hatch Act. So hopefully that this is just one of many people that we can actually say broke the law there.
I mean, the irony is that it would be really nice to say that this woman was kicked out for not doing her job. Almost all the Soros-funded DAs don't do their job. And by that, I mean their job is to prosecute criminals, and they don't do it. So they deserve to be fired for not doing their job, but you can't fire them for that. Why? Because they've been elected. Now, ordinarily, we'd say, well, then the people are to blame. If people want DAs who don't prosecute criminals, then people must like criminals, and then good for them. They're going to get more crime, and they obviously want it. But no, the point of the Soros-funded DA is that these are people who have not chosen this DA per se, or to put it differently, in races normally decided by, what, $300,000, $500,000. Soros puts in $1 million, as he did into Alvin Bragg's campaign in New York. Suddenly, this one guy is massively funded compared to everybody else. His or her commercials are everywhere. That's all the people see. They go, well, maybe this is a good guy after all. So the point is, there's a relentless propaganda, paid propaganda by Soros, that is getting these people into office. I mean, the good news is people are now aware of this. And so Soros' cover is blown. Yes, I mean, this is very good news.
So if you see a lot of political ads for someone, basically avoid, don't vote for them.
If they're on the left, I mean,
if they're on the left, but I'm just saying, I mean, there must be something behind these ads that get people to vote for it. So if you see something that looks too good to be true, it probably is.
Debbie and I made a New Year's resolution to lose weight, and thankfully, PhD weight loss came to their rescue. And what a rescue. Debbie has already lost 20 pounds, and it's just a few more to go. I'm now on maintenance, having lost a total of 27 pounds. The program is based on science and nutrition. No injections, no pills, no long hours in the gym, no severe calorie restriction, just good, sound, scientifically proven nutrition. It's so simple. They make it easy by providing 80% of your food at no additional cost. They tell you when and what to eat. And guess what? You can do this without ever being hungry. The founder, Dr. Ashley Lucas, has her PhD in chronic disease and sports nutrition. She's also a registered dietitian. She helps people lose weight and, most important, maintain that weight loss for life. So, hey, if you're ready to take the step of losing weight like Debbie and I have, called PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition. Here's the number. Write it down. 864-644-1900. You can also find them online at myphdweightloss.com. But once again, the number to call, 864-644-1900. It's time. I want to talk about how the racial politics inside the United States, which generates its own idiotic propositions and myths, is now being thrown out or projected onto the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is looking with disgust, with amusement, and also pushing back against what it sees as our factual and moral idiocies. Now, the latest example has to do with a Netflix series, a film, that is called Queen Cleopatra, and Cleopatra is clearly in the film black. Now, the thing about this is that according to the director of the film, this is a woman named Tina Gavari, she said, "I didn't like the idea that the old Cleopatra in the film that was made, what, 30 or 40 years ago, I guess in 1963, so 60 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, it was Elizabeth Taylor who played Cleopatra." So she goes, "Well, Cleopatra was falsely portrayed as white, and so I'm going to go the opposite and portray Cleopatra as black." So the black Cleopatra is supposed to be a corrective to Lily White Cleopatra of 60 years ago. But see, part of the problem with all this is that neither of these Cleopatras is really true to Cleopatra, the historical Cleopatra, the real Cleopatra. And this, of course, raises the interesting question, what was Cleopatra? Was she white? Was she black? Or was she some intermediate shade, more like me? Well, I think to answer this question, we have to make a distinction between race and skin color. This is not a distinction we're accustomed to making because we tend to lump the two together. If you take somebody in America who's coffee colored, a Whitney Houston, a Jesse Jackson, they're my color, but we call them black. Well, why? They're obviously not black. They're brown in complexion, but they're black because they have so-called black ancestry, which is to say they have African ancestry, but even African is a problematic term here because not everybody of African descent has so-called Negroid or Negro blood. The point being that Africa is a large continent. There are people who are racially Caucasian who live in Africa. I mean, think of somebody like Elon Musk. Elon Musk is obviously not black in the sense of skin color. He's obviously also not black in a racial sense. Now, he might have a 1 or 2% black, but I'm saying in the main, Elon Musk is a white guy. But on the other hand, his family hails from the continent of Africa, from South Africa in particular. So all of this is a way of saying that there's a difference between race, which is basically your physiognomy or your racial makeup, skin color, which is different. If you go to the continent of India, for example, the subcontinent of India, as you go across the country, you find people who are jet black. You have people who are all shades of coffee and brown and tan. And then you have Indians. Just look at some of the actresses in Bollywood who are virtually European in their complexion. So India is racially not Negroid. But on the other hand, Indians can be black or they can be dark brown or light brown or many shades in between. So anyway, the Egyptians, Cleopatra was from Egypt, know this. And so they look at this Netflix series, and apparently they've said, they've decided, this is nonsense. This is a joke. This is an embarrassment. And this is historically laughable and is being laughed at around the world. So the Egyptians go, we're going to make our own Cleopatra. And evidently there's a documentary channel in Egypt called Al-Watakiya. It's combining with another channel in, and they're basically going to do their own Cleopatra, and they claim that they are preceding the show with a series of conferences with, quote, specialists in history, archaeology, and anthropology to subject research the film and its image to the highest levels of research and scrutiny. So basically what they're saying is these Americans know nothing. They are trying to play politically correct games inside of America. And so Cleopatra used to be white, now she's black. And so they're going, we won't have it. You know, you do your nonsense, but don't try to project your nonsense onto us. Now, Cleopatra, by the way, was of Macedonian descent on her father's side. Her father was a Macedonian king. Where's Macedonia? In Greece. So in other words, the chance that Cleopatra was Negroid or Negro in her racial heritage is very, very low. Not everything is known about Cleopatra's ancestry, but what is known suggests that she wasn't. Now, Egypt, of course, is in fact in Africa. Egypt physically is located in North Africa. And yet again, if you look at Egyptians, think, for example, of someone like Anwar Sadat. Anwar Sadat looks black, and he was as dark as a lot of African Americans in this country. But on the other hand, Anwar Sadat's features are Caucasian. Anwar Sadat racially is not Negro or not Negroid, even though in terms of pure skin color, Anwar Sadat is black. So all of this is a way of saying that a lot of the stuff we hear about race in the United States is parochial. It's narrow-minded. It reflects not historical truth, but politically correct dogma. And the sad truth is that this kind of dogma is being pushed on our students, and the Egyptians, for one, are not having it. I think when it comes to towels, nothing compares to MyPillow towels. Mike Lindell has really hit a home run with his towels. Imagine having towels that actually work. Now, the MyPillow towels are soft to the touch without the lotiony feel. They have proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent. The towels kind of feel good, but they don't really absorb. MyPillow towels are available in multiple styles and sizes, made with 100% USA cotton, machine washable and durable, 10-year warranty, 60-day money-back guarantee. And Mike is now running a flash sale on the MyTowels. It's a six-piece set for $25. Wow, with promo code Dinesh. The towels are regularly $99.98. So it's an amazing offer. Includes two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So take advantage. Go ahead and call 800-876-0227. The number again, 800-876-0227. Or go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use the promo code D-I-N-E-S-H. Dinesh. I'm concluding my discussion today of the chapter called The Ghost in the Machine, Why Man is More Than Matter. And yesterday I made an argument drawn from the philosopher Immanuel Kant, which is that free will is a proof, is an indication that there is a part of our nature, of our human nature, that seems to exist outside the material world. Why? Because the material world is determined by the movement of atoms. It's determined by physical forces in the world over which, in most cases, we have no control. But, says Kant, the fact that we have free choice shows that we are not merely inhabitants of the material world. There's also a kind of noumenal or extra element that we have that allows us to make choices. Choices that have consequences. Now, freedom of the will means doing what we want to do or what we ought to do as opposed to what we have to do. A billiard ball that is hit by a stick doesn't have a choice. It's going to move in a predetermined direction and a predetermined velocity, but our decision to move that stick, that is a free choice. Freedom implies autonomy. And Kant says that makes our free choices different from what he calls natural inclination. What's natural inclination? Well, those are basically instincts. Animals operate by natural inclination. Now, if a dog sees a bone, it responds, in a sense, automatically. It's drawn to the bone, perhaps also drawn to a hydrant. The point being that the dog is not exercising free choice in the sense that we are. We're able to go against natural inclination. I'm naturally inclined to do this. Let's just say I feel hungry. I'm naturally inclined. But I say to myself, no, it's not really lunchtime. I'm going to wait an hour or two and then eat. That's free choice. So at least some of what we think and do is not governed by the necessity imposed by the laws of science. Now, hey, if I give a dollar to a guy on the street, the movements of our bodies are determined by nature, by physical laws, laws of gravity and motion and so on. But my choice to give and his choice to take, those are free decisions that we both make. Now, think about the implications of this, which are really quite profound. It follows from free will, that there is an aspect of our humanity that belongs to the world of science, and there is an aspect of our humanity that is outside the reach of scientific laws. Now, I realize that there are some scientists who will balk at this. Wait, what are you saying, Dinesh? So there's some part of your nature that is not within the world of science? Yeah, this is exactly what I'm saying. This is exactly what Immanuel Kant is saying. So simultaneously, we inhabit the realm of the phenomenal. The phenomenal for Kant is the empirical world, the material world, the world out there. And also the realm of the noumenal. The noumenal is the realm outside of space and time that is not subject to scientific laws and makes possible free choice, which is, of course, then implemented within space and time. Obviously, our choices are made in the world. They affect the world. They affect material objects. You know, when I pick up a pen, this is a material object. I'm exercising free choice upon this object. But then the laws of nature can take over. If I let the pen go, that's a free choice, but the pen will fall according to the laws of gravity. So materialism tries to understand us in two dimensions, space and time. But in reality, we inhabit three dimensions, space, time, and the noumenal domain, which includes free will. So to some people, it may seem a little fantastic that all of nature should obey these fixed laws, but there's just a single type of individual, well, hairy, omnivorous, bipedal, who can act in violation of these laws. But there is, and we are that animal. Moreover, we've discovered with the help of Kant that the material world is not the only world there is. This is a key point. And notice, by the way, that when Kant is making these arguments, he's not relying on the Bible. He's not quoting the book of Genesis or Leviticus. He's relying entirely on observational and philosophical arguments that are accessible to people, whatever your religion, or even if you have no religion at all. So what we've tried to show in this chapter, drawing on philosophers like Kant, is that materialism is wrong. It's an incomplete picture of reality. And contrary to its dogmatic assertion, there is a ghost in the machine, and the ghost can be called, for convenience, the human soul.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com. Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.